some wisdom, some serendipity, if I do, if I can use that word, to him find his way back here to the exploratorium. We got connected with Paul early in the year through a filmmaker friend of ours, Larry Cuba, who directed him here to do research. Paul is interested in, as we know, the politics of mobiles, which is a piece that was exhibited at Cybernetic Serendipities show, which debuted in London in 1968, and parts of which came over to the exploratorium thereafter. So the question was, on his hunt to recreate this piece, whose creator, Gordon Pass, Paul worked with in the as a PhD advisor, was there any evidence here still at the exploratorium that they looked to see any sort of documentation to help guide this journey, which was all kind of compelled by the 50th anniversary that will be coming up. Although we didn't have much to offer, I think that success was still found, and Paul will tell us more about this project and how it came to be realized just recently. So thank you, Paul.
Great. Thank you, Sam. And thank you, Liz, and thanks to everyone for coming. I know you have an incredibly busy week, and I look forward to visiting you all on Thursday night. I just wanted to, first of all, give an appreciation for the Exploratorium. I happen, as I shared with Liz, to have known Phil and Phyllis Morrison. And when I came some months ago and first met Liz and Sam and others, the affinity was immediately there. And then, of course, the Colloquy Project itself, I think, is a wonderful, warm way of knowing that, we all have a lot in common. I chair a two-year master's program in interaction design at the College for Creative Studies in Detroit. And as Sam has beautifully said, when it became clear that the 50th anniversary was upon us late last year, finally the light went off in my head, we endeavored to rebuild a full-scale replica. And I can tell you as much about that process as you like. I'd like to show you the examples of where we are in that process, which is, I would say, about 95%. And also to say that we've been thrilled to have a lot of response from the world community. So artists and media people and the ZKM in Germany that I know you're familiar with said, Margaret Rosen wrote to me, I didn't know her before, said, can you bring that thing that you're building, the Colloquy reproduction, to Germany? And of course, we would love to do that. But given the lineage with the Exploratorium, this conversation is particularly exciting to me. And I hope that there will be ways in which we can continue the conversation as time goes on. Let me do a very condensed version of things and then show you a longer story. But as quickly as possible, I'd like to come to a conversation about the things that you're interested in, the questions that you may have. This could be very long, and I know that, my time is short. The famous poster of the original show, which of course sits on your beautiful showcases outside. And in 1968, this was a crazy idea to imagine how artists and technologists and engineers could come together without those distinctions being made. This, I think, was the fundamental insight that Yasha Reichardt had when she invented the brief, if you will, for this exhibition. And I think you're quite familiar with it. There were a couple of interactive pieces. There's a robot there that you can see. This here was called Sam's, this organic-looking thing that followed you when you spoke, much like Albert, that you still have in your front way, that follows you when you move. And part of the story of the cybernetic serendipity 50 years ago was this man, Gordon Pask, who, as Sam said, I did a dissertation with and then worked with for many, many years afterwards. And I don't know how it happened, but he came about to create this thing called the Colloquy of Mobiles. Colloquy, of course, in the sense of colloquium. It's a much more common term in England than it is here. A gathering for conversations. And I'd like to explain it briefly to you all, because I think it's important to know. These figures, I can actually point. This is a female figure, so-called, and there are three of them, one, two, three. And these are male figures. There's one hanging here and another hanging there. So they're basically a rectangular piece with a light in the middle and sensors in the dangly bits at the top and sensors in the dangly bits at the bottom. And fundamentally, the way it worked was these were all autonomous, and they all rotated around their own axis. And the males not only rotated on their own axis, but also rotated on a bar. And it was a rather subtle interaction model that would take longer than we have time for to describe in detail, although I'm happy to discuss it. It was essentially a competitive, cooperative thing. where there were drives that the males had and the females had. And as they rotated back and forth, serendipitously, there would be a moment when a light from a male would hit perhaps the mirror on the female and reflect back, at which point the male got interested. Not a very subtle gender stereotype joke, right? Not subtle at all. But that was the beginning of the interactions, and then there were drive calculations and some other things that were rather sophisticated. And part of the presentation, again, we don't have time today, would be talking about the lineage of machines that Pask built before he got to this one, and then the ones that he built after, which led to his conversation theory, which is what I studied with him and did my dissertation work in. And the sophistication of that is still not seen when people today talk about conversation interfaces and voice interfaces and so on. This is far in advance of that. This is how it looked 50 years ago. Yolande Sonneben designed these female figures, and she became famous in the Royal Ballet doing designs there. The computing machinery 50 years ago was in these large bays and must have weighed a ton. We chose not to reproduce that. We decided we didn't need to have it happen exactly the way the electrons flowed. We did go, however, for visual accuracy and for interactive accuracy. It's hard to know how the gender role joke went. And there are movies, which are a little bit difficult to see, but I think instructive to run briefly. It should start on its own. Is it going to start? Yes, there we go. So this was taken in 16mm film and transferred at a time when digitization was not very good. So it's lost a lot in the VHS process. But you see the females rotating, you see the light on the male coming forward, and at some point you may see them in fact interacting in the appropriate way. Fast forward to 2018. This is how the exhibition looks. We're not exhibit designers. We're interaction designers, and we spent most of our time worrying about the veracity of the material, the veracity of the look, and ultimately the veracity of the interaction. So where we are now, as I say, is about 95%. I'll go into a little more detail of the scale model in a minute. The piece that we are still working on are the final moments of interactivity. All of the physical material is in place. All the motors and sensors are in place, and we're still tweaking the interactivity to match the way it needs to be. We expect in the coming weeks, literally before the 1st of August, to be quite done and to be able to show you movies that would interact much like the other movies that you saw. So here's a quick video of how it looks today. This is a couple of weeks ago. We've gotten a little further. And the sound is completely arbitrary at the moment. So the mirrors waggle, the males rotate around their arms, and it continues to take place. Of course, the beauty of it is you can walk amongst it. And part of the story is machines talking to machines. What a wacky idea 50 years ago. But when it's fully working, you'll be able to take a flashlight and interact with the mobiles as if you were a mobile. So it's people talking to machines. And you can even get a situation going where people, through machines, talk to people. And this, of course, is the world we live in today. And this is what's fascinating about the whole thing. So Pask somehow, 50 years ago, imagined the world that we live in today. And by making something that is organic and biological and emergent in its properties, somehow is telling us, wait a minute, you think those screens you're using are amazing? Why isn't it more organic? Why isn't it more conversational, ultimately? So I take it as a kind of chiding from 50 years ago. I want to give you a little taste of Pask himself. I know that it's a bit hard to understand him, so once the video starts, this will be his
speech. That is a machinery. It is visible, perhaps, for running a collective live house, it was called. That's the wrong way up here. These were large suspended live house, and I was taxed with the ability of making an exhibition piece for entertainment, in fact, with people who would engage in conversations through it. So I made a family of mobiles, which were these things, you know, anti-rotational beam, and varying out of the EPA computer smaller, and what in those days would be equivalent to a microprocessor, a load of junk in each one. Point being that the mobiles had a little life of their own. They kept to each other by beams of light, which they wagged on them down, and by putting sound and so forth, and anybody could go to that discourse if they wanted to, or to reject what they had up in front of the light. And they did.
And they did. The humans were invited to come along and be enticed by these devices. I know firsthand the story of a man whose name is Joe Zeidner, who wandered into the ICA 50 years ago and unexpectedly found this thing. He had no idea what it was, and he spent hours and hours playing with it. And as a consequence of that, he thought, I have to meet this guy, Gordon Pask. And as a consequence of meeting Gordon, he funded him for essentially 20 years from his organization in Washington, D.C., which was the Army Research Institute. And Zeidner was interested in this idea of learning and how humans learn and how humans can use machines to learn. And he realized that Pask had a way forward with that that no one else had. And I also participated in those contracts at some point. Well, there are many possible stories to tell. I would like to go a little further, if it's okay with you. Are there any questions right now? I can tell you a little bit about our archaeology, and also there are some papers here and materials you can take away. Yes?
You said the sound was arbitrary?
This sound was arbitrary.
Okay.
However, in the original, sounds were also used to communicate and to indicate. So there were lights that said, I'm here, are you there?
Uh-huh.
And there were sounds that indicated in particular which kind of drive you were looking for.
Ah.
So the sounds were used. I was not clear on that. Thanks for asking. And there's a lot of subtlety to that. In fact, so let me continue to answer your question list by saying, what did we have to work from? You've seen a movie. We had a movie to work from. We have a paper that Pask wrote in which he described in his own inimitable way, consider a female. She also has, females, an O drive and a P drive. These stood for orange and puce, which were his favorite colors. Very arbitrary. Unless both drives are satisfied, at which point she becomes a nerd, the female rotates and searches for a male. According to her drive state, she's receptive to males offering O or P or both. And it goes on and on. You can hear Freud in here somewhere. You might actually see Bauhaus somewhere in the actual design. That's another conversation. So we have this description, which was written before he built it. We have this diagram, plan view up above, so looking from above, the three females and the two males. Written before he built it. Flowcharts, written before he built it. And we have some of these in his original hand in the archive. We have photographs, of course, and then we have our imagination. We have the idea that we want to reproduce it in Detroit, full scale, looking the same and acting the same. This was the dream that was conjured based on a conversation between myself and close collaborator Hugh Dubberly, who's been very supportive of the project all along. So when we realized it, I immediately started to get a group of advisors together. So Pask's daughters, who are also executives of the various estates, Yasha came on board. She's very generous to come on board right away. I happen to know her already. Albert Muller runs the Pask archive. Pickering wrote a book about four great cyberneticians, of whom one is Gordon Pask, and so on and so forth. Wrote up something to begin to raise money and bring in the students. And in my MFA program, we have first year students and second year students, of course, and we engage a course, a studio course, at each year level. We looked at all the materials we had to deal with. TJ McLeish, of whom you'll hear a lot more, was involved in helping the students extract the scenarios. Here's an example. You read the prose that I just showed you from Pask, you do the drawings, you figure out what it means, and you try to get to code. This was one of the archaeological tasks. But of course, just doing this doesn't give you the full sense of it. So the students had the idea of doing their own playing of what the scenarios meant. And not only did they do the scenarios that they were interpreting from Gordon, you can turn down the sound, actually, there's not a lot here. But they also extrapolated scenarios for 2018. So if this stereotype thing with these satirical gender roles from 1968 didn't satisfy them, they could extrapolate what they wanted the gender roles to be. And the first thing they did was they made what they called, actually, let me tell you what it is first. It was a scenario in which the females and the males seemed more equal. The students, as you see, four of whom were women, thought it wasn't quite gender equal. So they made it gender equal, and they called that initial scenario revenge mode. I'm not quite sure what they meant by that. So here they are playing it out. And of course, arguing about it, because the archaeological history has contradictions in it. The movie seems to do this, what he says seems to do that. And so going through this process was interesting. You have to quantify the logic ultimately if you're going to be writing code. And then you have to consider it in the conversational mode that past began in. Again, that's the history of machines. It's a little beyond our talk today. But he had been interested in machines that interact like conversations from the early 1950s. He built playful interactive machines as well as a whole series of serious experimental machines to test how people interact and react in certain situations. So the students, on going back to this and all the other artifacts, created a program version of their own. They tightened it up, they made it much more specific. And you can go from that right-hand side right to code, whereas from past to original, you're pretty far away from that. So this course, which was Studio 4, Immersive Interactive Experiences Doing the Archaeology, would present to the other course. And I'll get back to that in a minute. This is how they extrapolated future scenarios. We brought in facilitators to talk about the gender roles and to really think about how they could extend it into the future. And different students did different things. Here was an interpretation of the same configuration as cities and startups, agreeing for mutual benefit. Participants in a conversation creating a flowchart de novo. A student did imagining a different way for the colloquy to interact. And then one user and three e-commerce companies. So using the imagination of the original configuration, but extrapolating beyond it in 2018. So this transitions us to the other course, which was a prototyping course and building Internet of Things. And they built the scale model that you've seen a little bit of. And they realized early on that this diagram is not correct. The configuration is actually an equilateral triangle, and where different bits and pieces are in past the original diagram and in the actual built version are different. And of course, we built it from the ultimate version, the version that was built. One of our instructors, fabulous character, who got the students from knowing nothing about hardware prototyping or Arduino or anything, got them to build the 1-6 scale model. Sophie is a exchange student from Austria. We had to tear her away. She just wanted to work on this endlessly, and she put in many, many hours after the end of the semester to get this thing to work. The scale model was a showpiece in the student show before we finished the exhibition itself. And here's this thing working. So. Here's the male mobile coming along. It comes to the point where it shines on the sensor and the female reacts, after which it will continue turning. It probably wouldn't work for a couple of days. After you ran it for a couple of days, it wouldn't work anymore because it was still just a prototype, but it fulfilled its function. We also did documentation workshops with this extraordinary character, Bruce McIntosh, who came in for it. We want to pass on what we've learned, and we want others to be able to replicate it if they so wish. So the student built their own website, colloquyofmobiles.com, with a lot of the historical artifacts, the pictures that you've seen. And finally, TJ McLeish was a master fabricator who made the reproduction of the full scale. So he went through a very methodical process. The students were kind of looking over his shoulder and supporting it, but the students can't be in the critical path. He's got to keep going. Remember, we started this in October, November of last year, and we only really began in earnest in January, and now we're almost done. So he looked at the photographic records. For example, every available image of the female forms normalized them, extrapolated from them, is that the right word? Drew from them, derived from them might be better, a 3D digital model, which looks like this when you render it, and when you do a 3D print of it, looks like that. If you were to simulate the images, these are very closely matched, so you see. This, by the way, is a card that explains the exhibit, and there doesn't seem to be any history of that. It's lots of fine print, we don't know what it says. So here are the females here, and so on. And similarly, a photographic record and the simulated version. We spoke to sculpture people inside of College for Creative Studies. I didn't explain, it's an undergraduate program as well as fine arts, sculpture, crafts of all kinds. It's very well known in the Midwest for those aspects, less so for the master's programs, which are much newer. The college is itself about 100 years old. We talked to local folks who were experienced in fabrication. TJ built a 3D model, which you can turn into this representation, which you then cut out of laser cut paper. You construct them into 3D molds, make foam core, stuff the foam core and lash it together, and glue it together, smooth it, wrap it in saran wrap, and then paint resin on it, and then you end up with this. So that was that process. Then you still have to build a structure. This is all TJ's work again. He looked at this material called 80-20, you're probably familiar with it. Designed this way of expressing a structure that would carry the weight. Designed all of these particular ways of hanging and rotating. Made paper cut and then Delrin material gears, all designed from scratch by TJ. Here we're bringing forms that were fabricated in Chicago by a third party into the space. We were delayed 2 months getting in the space because of structural engineering issues and fire marshal issues. Essentially, we were not allowed to move into the space for that period of time. Somehow we were treated not as a design prototyping situation, but rather as an installation situation. And losing that 6 weeks meant that we are now only finishing. We hoped to make it by the middle of May, but we'll make it by the middle of July, which is essentially the same period of time. So this is a process I'm sure you're very familiar with. Raising the structure, preparing the female forms. These are students who helped out in this part of the process. Hanging the whole thing, cutting out the male forms. These are temporarily out of foam core. We're going to do these all in Delrin as well. And we have the designs, we just need to execute them. Sewing mirrors. And TJ was also responsible for the electronics, looking through different possible components, deciding on those components, getting students to help test them. I don't know how they built this 50 years ago, what the analog to digital components were. Must have been a nightmare. And we're in the process now of turning them into circuit boards. So the goal was to make it replicable. Here I am cutting out paper in order to cut out the male dangly bits. And this is where we are. And we built materials, and that's where we are. And with that, I'd like to open it up to questions. There are many other things we could say. And again, I invite you to take some of these materials, which are also available visually. How are we doing on time? Yes, perfect, good. Yes,
it's interesting to me because your time scale, as you're saying, is phenomenally quick.
Mm-hmm.
And if you say, you know, it's like it dawns on you, oh, we're coming up to the 50th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, prototyping is an amazing process in and of itself because you can run into amazing failures that also then open up other possibilities.
Yes.
Did you, you know, it seems like you did a lot of intensive research before, but you're also translating and doing the fabrication. So how are you able to make that pace as quick as you have and reach even 95% with whatever roadblocks you walked into?
It's a lovely question, and I have to give TJ credit. He just kept going.
Yeah.
And even if we couldn't move into the space, he would keep fabricating in spaces he could get access to.
Yeah.
And he did, and he went as fast as he could under those circumstances. We robbed the students a bit of the experience of seeing all of it being made.
Yeah.
They saw the pieces being assembled, but because it couldn't be done in the space, they couldn't witness him. But he also went through iterations, and we have a bit of this in the photographic record. I didn't show you the versions of the gears he made that chewed themselves to bits.
Uh-huh.
And there were a number of those.
Yeah.
And in the process of actually doing his designs for those mechanisms, he feels like there's some originality in those. And we're about to approach the maker of the aluminum rods called 8020, probably familiar with them, and to say, hey, look, here are some novel ways of doing it. So we did the best we could, and we went hell-bent. Now, we have an upcoming semester in the fall and then the winter again, and we have the installation now, and very soon it will be fully operating. And it invites a number of other activities. First of all, to make everything more robust, to go from foam core to Delrin, and that's easy, that's not hard. But we want to have a symposium to discuss what does it mean to have a conversation with a machine? What did it mean for Pask in 68? Why did he talk about drives and do the gender thing? But what would our discussion be today? How would even the gender roles be cast differently? And the students who were talking about this gender fluidity and all that you might imagine that's in this common parlance today, they discussed. But also just the act of, I at home now can say, Alexa, what's the weather? Now that's not a conversation. That doesn't have the multiple layers that Pask built even into this thing 50 years ago. But it's a world we live in. So what does colloquy suggest for the world we live in? Well, it's stuff isn't really there, right? It's in the air. It's ubiquitous and unseeable. It's opaque. But if we think about this as an organic, emergent, conversational experience of the body where we're moving, what about that? Maybe we need more of that. And I'm looking forward to the conversations in interaction design courses that I teach to ask students exactly that question. Why is every idea you have an app? And other colleagues in other interaction design programs are going nuts. Everybody wants to make an app. No, we don't need more apps. So what does it mean to interact? What does it mean to converse, and so on and so forth? I should also say that we've raised almost $30,000. And we need another five or so to complete the prototype and, to be blunt, to pay TJ the tiny amount of money we're paying him compared to the amount of work he did. But we want to keep fundraising from there. And we would approach, of course, foundations to do symposia locally in Detroit where we could have these discussions in high schools and local colleges and so on. And in addition to ZKM asking to bring the colloquy there sometime, Penny Stamps School of Design, the dean there has expressed some interest. The local energy company is taking the power plant and maybe turning it into not a place like Exploratorium, that's impossible, but a collaborative space where communities of people can come and have interactions and so on. And another group called Design Core that's interested in the quality of design in general in Detroit is liaisoning the beginning of a conversation about maybe making a replica of colloquy and putting it there. But of course we have to finish it first. And we have to bring people and give them flashlights and have them go, whoa, that's interesting. But we hope to continue all of these things, fundraising, looking for other places to go. Actually, the University of Waterloo has a group that's asked for a consortium relationship. Their group is called the Living Architecture Systems Group. And this fellow, Philip Beasley, had followed my work, I didn't know that. But he's offering a small donation and some money for students to robustify the documentation of it for so a little bit of metadata about what we're doing. Sam?
Yeah, I think it's great. I appreciate the inquiry that you still kind of injected into the process, even though it was such a time constraint that there was still thinking about why it wasn't just let's remake it, let's also interrogate those decisions. Of course, we're still going to go with this, but I thought it was great to see the other ways of thinking about it, that those proposals that you showed, whether it's startups and cities or that. So this will have its life, it'll come to fruition, but could those other models that be applied on the same machinery, or would those see life as well?
Yes, it's a lovely question. So the same classes, same courses that you heard about go on in the coming year. So the immersive interactive experiences course could pick up where the prior one did, and when the programming is all working, then we'll have not quite an API, but we'll have the capacity to change the programming with the same configuration. And also, adding a microphone, excuse me, there's a microphone there already, and instead of looking in a certain band of sound, which is the O drive that's communication from one to another, it could be whatever the student wants. And of course, you can do AI in the cloud, and you can do voice recognition, and you could do speech, and all of these things could be added almost trivially, I mean, without much effort, because the technology is all easy if it's not already embedded here, and a lot of it is already embedded. And we do want to have those explorations. And again, always asking the question, what does it mean to have machines, talking to people, surrounding us every day? Because that's what we got. And to have an environment in which to have that exploration and have the conversation as well, both, right? Not just, hey, wouldn't it be interesting? It's like, yeah, okay, so do that. So let's see what that means when you make it. I also want to say that I've known about this since I met PASC 40 years ago. And I've always been curious, well, what was that like? What was the interaction really like? And I've seen all the pictures. But standing in this thing, it's a whole different world. Well, you must know that, right? You imagine an installation, and then you stand in the installation and go, whoa. Because we are biological creatures, and we have this interaction with our environment, which is different than our imagination, which is different than behind some screen. That's why I keep on talking about the organic quality of it. That's important, that seems to matter. So the conversations that we had, both with students and with the public, in the abstract versus standing inside it and moving around in it were different. And that difference was fascinating. It was more emotional, it was more curious, it was more, I don't know, I don't want to say mystical, but it's like, wow, what's possible here? Change. Other questions? Yes?
We're usually used to thinking about, you know, technology as sort of progress and improvement. I was just curious if there were ways in which you guys encountered situations that maybe the older technology made things easier or that were harder to replicate with the Arduinos, or was it simply easier?
I don't think there was anything that was harder with the modern digital Arduinos and sensors and light sources and so on, because the range of flexibility of all of those things is huge, and the range of flexibility of those two small refrigerator-sized things that they had to build with all of the clumsy analog to digital conversion.
I guess part of what I was wondering is sometimes, you know, in art, certainly, sometimes limitation, restraint and limitation helps shape ideas in interesting ways. And I wonder to what extent this work is a product of the limitations of the time, and if those limitations had a beneficial effect or allowed, you know, ideas that maybe we can't see with all the possibilities we have and the flexibility of current technology.
I love the way you're framing the question. My experience with PASC was always that his ability to conceptualize something meant that he could make it in whatever technology he had in front of him. So a roundabout way of answering the question is, he built a training system where a student had to do a lot of reading, but he didn't have enough storage on the 8-inch floppy disk to store all of that information. But the machinery could turn on an LED above a cubby hole so that the student could pull out a clipboard and read something that was printed. So it didn't matter that the technology couldn't do it. What mattered was that he knew what he wanted to see happen. And so I feel that in general, he started there, and the whole conceptualization of this as a conversation and the different drives, and there are multiple layers in the drives, and there's a competitive cooperative thing that I didn't go into detail about. He conceived all of those things and then found a way to embody them. That doesn't contradict what you're saying. I'm sure that in the making, a lot of compromises occurred. But past more than other work of that kind, he wasn't an artist, remember. Well, of course, he was an artist, but he didn't come from art. He came from experimentation. He was a maker before we had that word. And there's an video I could show. I'm happy to share. It's in this deck. And I'll share this, the PDF of the deck with everyone. He's got a soldering iron in his hand, and he's putting things together, and he's making a series of machines in order to ask certain kinds of questions. He didn't start with a philosophical point of view. He started with experimenting with people and machines talking machines, and from that he extracted his theory. And the robustness of that theory, I think, comes from the robustness of experimentation. So, to try to come full circle in your question, I think he started out with a strong concept and found a way to put that within the limitations of a given technology, where I'm sure there were compromises that shaped his possibilities based on what he did. It becomes a little bit different. You want one? Would it be fun to have one? It's built to be dismantled and moved.
So the artist question,
yes.
I realized, yeah, thinking of the speech that he talked about how he was taxed with this, and to make something that would entertain, and that kind of language made it seem like it was burdensome to him, or, you know, foreign to a way he would usually operate. So did he have any other artistic expressions around this, or do you think that that evolved his thinking?
I think every machine he built evolved his thinking. The first machine he ever built,
do we have a couple more minutes? In a context of more time, so this is what he looked like in the early 50s. And around 1953, he conceived and built something that he called music color. And this is how it worked. The musician improvises. The machine listens and compares to what came before. It's very important that the machinery has a memory. As a consequence of a computation, it creates a response on lights. And the lights are then seen by the musician, making a closed loop, a conversation. Now, what this looked like was he would travel around venues in England to music halls, which in the 50s after World War II were not terribly active, I think, so they were available, at least they had dances. And he would set up a series of lights that would shine on the screen. This is just a suggestion, it's not literally how it worked. And the electronics were bulky and complex, and all of the stories that talk about this, both what he's written and his wife Elizabeth wrote, who was on the journey with him, it tended to catch fire. But that was because it was this level of complexity, and it was all analog. There was no digital involved at all in 1953 in this device. But what's important is to tell you what actually was going on. So I have to do a little sort of role play here. Let's imagine that the musician is playing from middle C to C above C and begins to play a little ditty. Okay. First of all, the device adjusts itself so it has some response. It has to adjust its sensitivity, so it's a kind of first order feedback. So let's imagine you're playing in here and the musician is seeing a result. Great. Keeps going. But music color doesn't want to keep going. Music color gets bored, and instead of listening in this frequency range, changes the frequency range in which it's listening. So the musician is doing this, and it's not responding anymore. Oh no, it's not responding. Well, I'm going to improvise up there. Oh, it's not responding. Let me improvise. Oh, now it's responding again. And it did this in five separate channels. So the musician essentially doesn't know what's going on literally, but is changing what they're playing as a consequence of this interaction. And the topology of this, if you will, is two layers of interaction. There's the simple feedback loop layer and the changing of the goals, the getting bored part and the shifting around. This was the first machine he built. This was many, many years before other things. Let me just do this quickly. He then built a pupil machine and a teacher machine in which one would teach the other. And it had the same architecture. In other words, it had multiple layers in it, much like people do when they have conversations and when they learn things. And it's instructive to look at a close-up of one of the panels of the pupil machine. And you'll notice some really fun stuff here. So there's an awareness knob for changing the external awareness of the pupil. It gets to be more fun. There's another knob that determines the amount of obstinacy of the pupil. Isn't that fantastic? It gets even a little better. There was something called oblivescence, which means willful forgetfulness. So here's this panel on this machine teaching on this machine being taught by another machine in the 1950s, and this was a sensation. And he was written up a lot in the press, and this is in the archive. Not only that, but he was also the subject of a BBC documentary. It was an entire, I don't know if it was an hour, but it was an entire episode of something called The Experimenters on the BBC. And let me give you a little taste of it.
In this program, we look at some of the ideas and experiments which he and his team are creating based on his theory of how we learn.
Excited. Sending fibers removed.
Gordon Pask has now been developing his theory of learning for many years, and as an engineer, at the same time devising his own learning machines. What was deficient in the existing theories to make him start?
I think that a lot of existing theory and experimental work was inappropriate to the field of education, where you're dealing with people who have to learn large bodies of subject matter, and do so by very complicated processes.
As he's developed and built a range of teaching and related machines, he's now extending the current system, a learning machine called CAST. It's the culmination of a sequence which started in 1953. It included a pattern recognition system. Eucrates, a sort of simulated student. The fox and goose tracking system, and a unique teleprinter trainer. CAST, C-A-S-T-E, stands for Course Assembly System and Tutorial Environment.
This sort of thing, giving, say, two explanations at once, could be represented by putting a marker of some sort on some of these and saying, we're dealing with conversations as the things we study. We're not much interested in what the conversation is about, we're interested in how it takes place. And the hypotheses we test are about how people understand or learn or what can be known and can't be about processes in conversations. I mean somebody with the wit and the guts to go and do and create. And that, I believe, is what education is all about.
Other questions? There could be other things to say. His influence at places like MIT, which is where I first met him when he came to Nicholas Negroponte's lab talking conversation theory. And we built a series of proposals. We didn't get so far as to build machines based on those proposals about graphically interpreting conversation and trying to mix graphical interfaces with conversations. And he influenced Negroponte a great deal in this lab that was called the Architecture Machine Group, where the hypothesis was that you could have a machine that you could talk to do design. So not just getting a machine to do the renderings or the draftings or the calculation about how big the beam should be, but rather you could talk about the goals of the design conversation and the design activity. And he had an architecture for actually doing this. And it's that architecture that I've applied in startups and in my dissertation with him, which was a training system, essentially. And it's what Colloquy did. And it's what perhaps machines could get to be done today. That was bad English. All the conversation stuff that's being discussed today about conversational interfaces is really just about texting back and forth or getting something spoken in two directions. But those aren't necessarily conversations in the sense that means, where we have goals involved and we have actions that we might take as a result of the conversations we have. That's what's rich about conversation. It's when we share our understanding, we learn from each other, we decide, yes, let's collaborate on this activity which has these goals. Now we will act to do that. That's what conversation is about. Conversation leads to a change in what you know or a change in action. That's his definition. And that's what all of these machines have embodied. And there's a lesson there as well. And Colloquy starts that and certainly embodies a way of thinking about interfaces that are, as I keep saying, organic and emergent, conversational, rather than digital and opaque and behind glass walls. Any other questions?
I was just wondering if you could touch on how is PASC's approach similar or different than, for example, you know, Siri or Alexa and the kind of structural model of that kind of interaction?
I don't see anything of PASC in Siri and Alexa. And when I talk to some of the folks who design those interfaces, I've spoken to a few, they're all at the level of understanding the utterance and getting a response in a transactional sense. What PASC is all about is, even in the few minutes that we've been together, we've established a shared understanding to some extent. I've said things that you probably understand, you've asked questions that imply your interests. And so we're building a mental model of each other on the fly, second by second. That's what the socialization that comes from the capacity for speech has brought about to society, right? Over tens or 100,000 years, this ability to converse has led to the society we have, for better or worse. Because it's only through conversation that we understand, learn, collaborate, and act together. There's nothing in Siri, and there's only a tiny bit in Alexa, which tries to build a context of shared understanding. So if the second day I say to Alexa, play that again, it doesn't know what I mean. Whereas if I see you on the street tomorrow and you say, great lecture, I know what you mean. You might say bad lecture, that would be more instructive. That would be more helpful. You see what I mean? So until there's an interest in understanding why conversation works, and that's what PASC's theory is all about, it works in part because of these layers of shared understanding that build as a consequence of the interaction, which lead to our capacity to have shorthand, to have an efficient way of interacting, such that we can work together. I mean, you've worked together for many years, you have many shorthands, whether you know it or not. And it's because of the shared experience and the trust that it has come from that you're able to do what you do so well. I don't see any of the discussion in any of the Scholastic papers, in any of the people that I speak to, or in any of the functions. Oh, I'm sorry, in Alexa you can define your own blueprints now. Do you know about that? So if I go home and I say, Alexa, what do you know about Gordon PASC? It gives my definition. But it does that because I typed in those two sentences. That's not an improvement, except I can program it. Right, it's a little better, but it's not an improvement toward a passing an idea. And of course we know that the relationships we have with people, whether it's the barista who knows something that you like or that you work around the corner, or the person that you've had a longer term relationship with, whether a personal one or an organizational one or a neighborly one or a political one, those kinds of relationships build because of a shared experiences and the shared knowledge, ultimately the shared values. And without that, Alexa and Siri are always going to be stupid.
How much of that do you think has to do, I just wonder, and you know, maybe this is a whole other conversation, but I suspect that a lot of that has to do with human discomfort. You know, I'm sure that Google and Amazon and Apple have looked into, they have a lot of data about us, which people would probably feel pretty uncomfortable if the AI started to express how much it actually could remember or know about us. Well, so I wonder how much of that is a sort of a marketing question.
I believe you're giving them the benefit of the doubt that they don't deserve, because you're implying that they know what we're talking about now and want it. I don't see the evidence of that. But I also see evidence of the thing that you're saying that maybe they don't have. They have all that data that they're screwing us with. you know, that they're using in ways that we don't want them to use it. So they're not hesitating for that reason. So this is a conversation I'd like to have, actually, with, in a lot of different contexts. And maybe colloquy can stimulate conversations like this in other kinds just because it exists. There would be a discomfort involved if my machinery knew too much. But does that come from my mistrust of what's behind that machinery?
I think that is the
organization that's behind it is what I don't trust, right? It's not necessarily the technology. But if a company like Apple came along and said, look, we don't send anything to the cloud, it's all happening locally, we don't have your personal data, we don't want it, then maybe the world would be different. This is really geeky. But Alexa sends everything you say to the cloud.
Yeah.
Apple has a chip in the phone which prevents anything going anywhere until it's sure you said, hey Siri. It's specifically for security purposes. And after you say, hey security, and hey Siri, and this chip lets that go, it's then checked again in the cloud, and only then does it take a listen and send yourself to the cloud. So they're already concerned about that in a way that is much deeper than these other companies. I don't know that Apple will get what I'm talking about. I wish they would, and we would have a better experience, and I would trust them more than other people.
Well, that brings us close to the end of our time, but I'm sure you'll stay around to...
I'm around, yes. And I'd love to hear from you, and I'd love... There are some things here to take. You can reach me at colloquy2018@gmail.com.
And I'll get the deck from you.
Yes, I'll send you the deck first. And thank you for your time and attention. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
That
embodiment,
yeah.
It was so, I mean, I didn't think about it ahead of time, but the shift was amazing.
Yeah, but what would a physical Siri or a physical Alexa look like? You know, just like visualizing those things that we don't see or choose to put underground.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because we...
Hi, sorry, I'm late.
Oh, this is wonderful.
Great.
Yeah. We didn't distinguish between the art-made pieces and the science-made exhibits that we have. And when you mentioned in the beginning, I was like, all the neat potential inherent influences, some of them are evidence to me,
yes,
by our participation in the cybernetic. But some, then I still...
You can get you more of these, please take.
Is this a pack?
Yes, it's all a set. That's the original passport.
Did you get one of these?
We can share.
Because I can also get another.
That's okay.
And I'll send you the digital version.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Yeah.
And write to me if you have questions. I'd love to hear
them.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
These are some of our young staff who
wonderful
teach our grammar school kids when they come
fantastic
in. And they help us create all kinds of temporal experiences for our public, because they know the floor and our exhibits so well.
That's great.
And
that's what I do.
So you tell them where to go. That's great. I'm Paul, by the way.
Colin.
Colin, pleased to meet you.
Karen.
Thank you for the talk.
Pleased to meet you both.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming.
Everything we do is about interaction, so.
Understood.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I was excited to come back and tell you what was going on with this.
Yeah. But it is amazing to hear the small things and go, oh, I wonder if that was part of the impetus of why we decided. Because I know this was the first traveling exhibit that the Exploratorium hosted,
yes,
of all our exhibits. And so there's, you know, obviously we kept some of the work.
Yes.
And then some of those, the kind of language around it and
yeah,
everything that I just... You just learn as you come into a place, but you're not aware of the subtleties and the nuances that drive
right
ways of thinking.
Right, exactly. There's so much I wish I could ask of the people who built this thing, Gordon included.
Yeah.
The guy who built the electronics, Yasha for example, thought was still alive, Mark Dowson, but I can't find him. I think he must have passed away.
Yeah.
And I know Tony Watts, who worked in Pask's lab, who I knew personally, he's not with us anymore.
Yeah.
So we have to infer and make clear what we're inferring and what we read to make the history distinction clear.
Right.
You know, the stuff we're making up in part and the stuff that we're passing on.
Tristan Duke's an artist. He's up from LA. He's an artist in residence with us.
Is he the guy with the beard?
Yeah.
Oh, that's Tristan. Great.
Yeah, and he has a book. He was, you know, on the sixth.
Please take.
No one else is.
Yeah, I know. Thank you again.
Thank you very much. It's great fun. Thanks, Kim.
Influence star or thinking here.
Yeah, it was at the origin, right? So it must have had some influence.
Yeah. It had a lot of influence on Frank. And then when you mentioned that Pask, the person who supported Pask was out of a...
Army Research Institute, Joe Zeidner.
In Washington. And, and then I started going, I wonder if that's why this came from London to Washington. Who knows? But what were those, you know, kind of those conversations that just... made history in ways that we're not aware of.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
As we try to uncover this as well. So thank you.
Thank you very much,
Liz,
and I appreciate all of your arrangements in the middle of everything else going on.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, it's really great for us to kind of take these slices and think about, as you say, contemporary practice and kind of cultures we live in and what those influences are and...
Yeah, and what we can take from the history.
Totally applicable, to our own exhibit design, how, you know, we're a museum of interaction. What's known for, so how do we provoke in the best ways possible?
Yeah, and create the conversations.
Yeah.
You don't have to embody those in a machine, but you want to cause them.
Yes.
Right.
Catalyze them, and I'm sure that's what these folks are, you know, Colin does when people get brought around, you know, you ask questions.
Yeah, it's interesting, because also the way you design courses so the students could, you know, just have something, the history, and rethink in terms of modern times.
Yeah.
You know, that it's like, it's inquiry-based learning in so many ways. It is iteration, it's building up, it's testing, and...
And you don't know where it will go.
Yes.
You know, it's emergent in that sense.
Yeah.
There were two issues that I ran across. One was, you can't build that until we make sure it's safe. And that delayed us, as I said.
Well, we also often run into that.
Yeah.
Not in the old days.
Very sensitive fires the system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the other question was, and in fact, it was the president of the college who said this to me. He said, yeah, Paul, I heard you're doing this. Why would you rebuild something that's 50 years old? And I thought, well, I have to work on answering that question carefully.
Yeah.
And I'm not fully there yet. He hasn't seen this deck, for example. He came to the opening night and he's listening. But I want to come back to him and show him what the students did.
Yes.
And how they spent their time.
Yes.
And what they got involved in.
Yeah.
And it's completely different than you read in a book what somebody did and you write a critique on it.
Right.
This is not that.
Yeah.
This is experiential.
Yeah.
This is experimental.
Yeah.
And then inviting them to extrapolate.
Yeah.
What would you make? Okay, you think that's sexist and silly. Okay, what do you got?
Yes,
what are you going to make?
Exactly.
And that was fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad that you presented those processes.
Good.
Because I think it's the same thing. You know, there's artists that we worked with in the beginning of the Exploratorium's history who were in residence with us.
Uh-huh.
And they get forgotten.
Yes.
And their work, you know, maybe... It leaves the floor because it was tricky to maintain.
Yes.
Or it goes off because now we send exhibits all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the new generation comes along. And, you know, you're going like, oh, you're riffing. Oh, no, you don't even know that you're riffing.
Right.
And
right.
Taking it all new places. But, you know.
And if you lose the history, then everyone loses the benefit of standing on the shoulders.
Exactly,
and they're reinventing the wheel. Sorry, too many metaphors.
Right. Oh,
and that's why the history is important. You know, let them discover, but let them also build from what has already been thought.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you go up a bit and then you go down again, you go up a bit down instead of like this.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway. to overly linearize it. You know?
Yeah. Great.
Well, great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Liz. I really appreciate it, Sam. Thanks for everything.